Steve.
Hey, Emma.
What do you do when you really like something?
You know what I do, Emma? I talk to all my friends about it. What do you do?
That's a great idea, Steve. I even tell strangers on iTunes how much I rate and review it.
What a great idea.
Hello, my name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist and welcome to the Zeitgeist Tapes. I'm joined as always by Professor Steve Fielding. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener.
And I'm delighted that this month we're joined by Dr. Sarah Lonsdale, who is a senior lecturer in journalism at City University and also the author of The Journalist in British Fiction and Film. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Hello, Emma. Hello, Steve. Hello, listeners.
So this month we have been looking at The Ploughman's Lunch, which was a 1983 drama. I think for the BBC, Steve, is that right?
I think it was for Channel 4. I think it was one of the first Channel 4 films.
Right.
Yes. And the plot of the film, as Emma said, it was released in 1983. It's set in 1982. And 1982 is the year of the Falklands War, and involves the principal protagonist is James, who's a BBC journalist. He's not a proper journalist, or he's not a reporter. He's someone that does a very highly technical job where he makes sure that the radio news actually runs for a certain amount of time. So he's a technical journalist in many ways, but he's very ambitious. He's also an outsider. He's not really Oxbridge. He's not part of the clever set, but he has very big ambitions. He wants to write a book and make a name for himself as a historian. And because of the Falklands War, and because he's very ambitious, and because it's 1982 and the right are in ascendancy, he wants to write a revisionist history of the Suez Crisis in light of the Falklands War, which basically defends what the British did in Suez in 1956. And so the film kind of traces his ambitions along that front, as well as a relationship that he establishes or tries to establish with another journalist, Susan, who is in fact the daughter of a radical historian. And there's another character, his best friend, Jeremy, as well, who kind of sets him up with the historian's daughter, as well as a historian, in order to help him. But ultimately, James is betrayed by Jeremy and Susan, who go off together. And James is a kind of very interesting character in himself. He's, like I say, he's an outsider who's trying to get on. He's a very ambitious journalist come historian, who looks back and sort of almost betrays his own family that comes from kind of more humble backgrounds. At one point he says his mother and father are dead. In fact, his mother is dying, but he's not interested in his family. He wants to distance himself because they're from like lower middle class, upper working class background, not the kind of family that he would want to associate with. So it mixes things about politics, things about journalism, things about history, and is kind of a reworking of the basic Orwellian theme about how the present makes the past convenient for itself. And it's about power and how power influences how people think about the past and the present. So it's got all these kind of very big themes flying around in a very kind of a horribly cynical film. But I it's one of my favourite films, whatever that means about me, I don't know. But it's one of the films that I've watched quite a few times. And it is kind of depressing, very cynical, but very, very interesting about what it says about those themes I've just mentioned.
It's got an extraordinary pedigree, hasn't it? I mean, it's written by Ian McEwan and directed by Richard Eyre, both of whom were getting to sort of reasonable heights even at the time and have now sort of gone on to incredible things. This is not a kind of throwaway bit of Channel 4 drama. Sarah, you've obviously written about journalists. How realistic or how cynical is this?
Well, I think it is quite a cynical look at journalism, but I do think it's deliberately cynical. we need to immediately clock that it's written by Ian McEwan, the novelist. And there's a long and honourable tradition of novelists and writers of fiction putting the boot in to journalism. They've always seen journalism as a rather shabby and disreputable form of communication. They are the highbrows and journalism is the lowest form of cultural production. So you immediately have Ian McEwan coming from a very critical stance, but that's not to reject the criticisms he has of journalism in the film, of which there are very many. And I think it's very interesting. It's one of the few films, one of the few pieces of fiction I've seen about journalists, which has representatives from print, radio, and television. So you've got the Jeremy Hancock is a print journalist. James Penfield is radio, and Susan Barrington is television. So it's a multimedia world that Ian McEwan is criticising. And let's face it, they're all pretty awful characters, both professionally and morally. So, interestingly, Susie, she's treading on her sort of feminist sister's agenda to get to the top. She kind of kowtows to the kind of male hegemony of the office to get to the top. Jeremy obviously sleeps with his best friend's crush, and James, at that moment when he's on the phone to his father about his dying mother, and he tells the radical historian he's with, "Oh, it's just a relative of mine is unwell." It's just a terrible moment. It's kind of like Evelyn Waugh territory in its cynicism. So they're awful people, but they're also terrible journalists. They're not interested in holding power to account at all. I think the very interesting thing is that the only real kind of news event we see them at is the Conservative Party conference. You know, we know this is the last party conference before Margaret Thatcher's khaki landslide. But they're not interested in holding the Tories to account. They're interested in their own personal ambitions and getting off with each other.
Sounds like party conference to me.
Yes. One other news event is this women's peace camp that James Penfield comes across on his way back from Norfolk. This is kind of ordinary, real people trying to make a protest against the war, against nuclear weapons, and he's just not interested in them. He says, "Oh, I'm news, not features," as if they're not news. And that raises the question, you know, what is news to the mainstream media? But also he tells somebody about them later and he just says they're mad. He absolutely dismissive of anyone outside that power bubble of the mainstream media and high politics.
I mean, I thought it was I think one reason why I liked it is because the way in which it mixes up what the characters with almost cinema verite, really. I mean, that when they're in, it's kind of superficial, but when they're actually shot, the characters are actually shot in the same frame as the Conservative Party conference and the platform. And, you know, they walk in and Heseltine's banging on about the professional left in local government. And you get Francis Pym talking absolute whiffle about the stand of principle during the Falklands War, and you get James discovering that he's being betrayed by his best friend and the girl that he had a crush on during the course of Margaret Thatcher's kind of end of conference speech when she's banging on about the Falklands. So it's kind of a bit superficial, but that's one of the, I think, the pleasures of it. And you get shots of grimy London, and so it looks really real. And in another way, the other thing that's appealing is that a lot of the themes are relevant to today. I mean, the meeting when James, the editorial meeting at the BBC, when James basically says, after saying, yeah, I'll try and maybe I'll say something about to the peace camp campaigners who help him out with his, you know, flat tire. And then he's asked, as Sarah said, you know, he'd kind of just say, oh, the bunch of nutters. There's a discussion that I guess, I don't know what the editor or whoever's in charge of BBC Radio News is talking about, well, you know, we give, on the one hand, we give the multilateralists position and we give the unilateralist position, but then they critique us, the unilateralists say, we're giving a militarist version of the truth. And they all kind of laugh at that. But that's kind of, that's, you know, how the BBC deals with news. It's just like it is today.
This idea of kind of balance, yes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the interesting things I thought was in terms of, yeah, that they're so dismissive of everything outside of their very narrow sphere of interest. So not just the way they treat the peace camp, but even the way they treat their friend, the poet, who does yes. poetry reading and then is asked questions by ordinary people afterwards. And they just can't stop laughing at them. Now, I'm afraid that my note for that literally has the words Lou Beale written in massive capital letters.
Yes, she is. Yeah.
Which slightly detracted from the moment for me. But it was they, you know, what they're interested in is in no point are they interested in investigating ideas or why anything is happening, which for me is kind of journalism 101. Where is the power dynamic? What is happening? Why is it happening? Actually, they're just interested in being players in that game. And that is, you know, that's something that we've started talking about a lot on the left now, because we do have much more activist journalists crossover. But that's, you know, there is a genuine critique that says there always was activist journalist crossover. It's just that we didn't see it because it was called the establishment. Just turned into Owen Jones, but...
and James wants to become part of it, doesn't he? That's his... That and although he gets his book published, the division between him and everybody else is kind of marked out by the fact that his best friend has it away with the girl that he wants, because they are to get they're both from Oxford, you know, they're allies, long term allies. He's still an outsider, even at the end of the film.
Mm. It's hard to feel too sorry for him, given you have to remember he did shag her mum.
No, but that was kind of a bit involuntary in his defence. I'm not entirely sure that he sought that. I think that was thrust upon him, as it were.
Well, there was thrusting.
Ooh,
it was more her than him.
I'm sure he could have polite. I'm sure he could have made his excuses and left.
No one has sex out of him. But well, actually, that's not true. Lots of people have.
I think actually there's a profound point to be made in this actually, because he, you know, when he's with the publisher, who he wants to sell this kind of right-wing revisionist book about Suez, the publisher says, he's stuffing his face all the time, the publisher, he said, "Oh, you're not a socialist, are you?" He said, "Oh, no, I'm not a socialist." And then when the radical historian says, "You are a socialist, aren't you?" "Oh, yes, I'm a socialist, yes." Basically, he is somebody who will say or do anything to get his way. So, you know, in a sense, acceding to her, you know, basic amorous desires is part and parcel. He has got no soul. He has got ambition, but he's got nothing else about him.
Absolutely. No, he's a moral vacuum. All he's interested in is serving his ambition. And that's why I didn't feel sorry for him at all when his best friend got the girl. In fact, I didn't feel anything towards any of them. They were, and I think this is, I mean, often a lot of Ian McEwan's characters do have a kind of moral vacuum, and one is very unsure what to feel about them. I mean, he did another journalist character in his novel Amsterdam, who was an editor of a newspaper. And again, he was an empty shell as well. All he was his ambition and his work. And there was nothing inside of him. In fact, there's a line from the novel which says, you know, it was like he was already dead. He was not there at all. It was just his kind of speaking body that that was there. He had actually gone years ago.
Actually, because James himself basically says that he feels nothing. So Ian McCune has him to say that. So maybe that's his general view about he's not got a very high opinion of journalists, clearly. But the poet, though, because when you mention the poet, he's one of the few characters, and it fits in with maybe he was Ian McEwan's vision of himself. He's the one that is rather than he's nice, he's honourable, he's doing his poetry thing, and so maybe it's the poet. But the poet, you know, when in that poetry reading when the other two are laughing, they fall about laughing when a very earnest man says, what is the role of the poet in society? And they all collapse because the very idea that a poet has a role in their society is just absolutely hilarious. But I think the poet is the one that comes across as he's untouched by all this ambition, isn't he?
Yes. Although, I mean, even he is mediated. So he's introduced as having been described by the Sunday Times as a cross between Dante and Philip Larkin, which I think is a hilarious. I mean, what is a cross between Dante and Philip Larkin? I just can't even envisage that. But again, it's through the prism of the Sunday Times, which obviously in the early 1980s was, well, it still is, but it was a hugely influential newspaper in the arts and culture. And actually, a lot of these literary writers, Martin Amis, Julian Barnes, reviewed for the Sunday Times and reviewed each other's books. It was quite an incestuous world, and I think the fact that they're quoting the Sunday Times as the final word on who this poet is, and this fatuous description of him being crossed between Dante and Philip Larkin, I think says a lot about the way that even the kind of literary writer, the poet, is trapped and mediated by this overweening, all-powerful media machine that we're in.
Mm. Although, to be fair to the poet, he does then say, well, that's journalism. Yeah. So at least...
But maybe, as Sarah said, that's Ian McEwan's voice coming through there and his opinion on journalism.
I think so, yes.
I mean, one of the things that really struck me, there are two things that I think are interesting to unpack, and I particularly like your view on the first one, Steve, which is, it might be that I'm just 10 years too young, but I have never had a very strong opinion about the Suez Crisis. It's for me, it's as ancient history as the Victorians. But obviously, in 1983, it seems very relevant and important and as big part of like national identity. So I was wondering whether they've just put that in to make the comparisons with the Falklands fly, or if that was how we genuinely felt about Suez still at that point.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, though, in the film, they've got this historian who's on tape. And he basically tells the audience what the Suez Crisis was about, in a way. So by 1983, not everybody would necessarily have known what the details of the crisis was. But I think many people would have thought, it was a terrible thing. You could read it two ways. It was, if you're a conservative, it was a national humiliation, and if you're on the left, it was showing up the elite to be lying swines, you know, hypocritical, you know, power mad people who would basically lie themselves into doing anything because it was all based on the conceit that the British and the French were going in to separate the combatants, the Israelis and the Egyptians. And, you know, the British and the French are in cahoots with the Israelis. They started the war so they could be separated, so the British and the French could get their hands back on the Suez Canal. So I think in whichever spectrum you're on, Suez was an important point. But it was very, very different in terms of what kind of view you would have taken. But I think I think generally by that point, if you knew anything about the Suez Crisis, you would have known it was a very bad thing. And the idea that they're actually comparing the Falklands with the Suez Crisis is a bit disingenuous because it wasn't quite, you know, the Falklands wasn't a made-up mm-hmm. thing. You know, the Argentinians did invade. It wasn't anything to do with the British. But nonetheless, yeah, it was a very big issue, and they bring in the radical historian who makes that very point that for her generation, that it was one of the defining aspects of politics. And actually, do remember when David Owen, former leader of the SDP, when he wrote his autobiography, many people picked up on the point because he was a student during 1956, and he was working with labourers. He was digging some holes, and he basically made the point that all these working class blokes were really in favour of Suez because they wanted to give it to NASA. So and people thought that's a remarkable thing for a supposedly left wing politician to be saying, because he said, and I agreed with them. You know, I saw their point. So it was a very big polarizing event, I think, like the Iraq War. I mean, possibly, yeah. I think the comparison would be with the Iraq War.
Right. I mean, that's just, as I say, for me, I was 8 in 1983. So, and it's just never been part of my narrative. So, I've just noticed in a lot of the British stuff that we've been doing, it's been a huge thing. So, it was a big part of The Crown and now obviously this. So, it's quite interesting. The other thing that I thought was very interesting is that these are, well, I say these people, but that's not true. They're not all proto-yuppies. James is a proto-yuppie because he is the one that is genuinely upwardly mobile. If readers, listeners can't know, here, see this, but I'm putting the upwardly in air quotes there because I'm entirely sure he's going up. But, you know, he's the one who's come from a working class or at least lower middle class background. Whereas it's quite clear that Jeremy and Susan are already posh and rich, so they're not technically yuppies. They're just people who are already experiencing the heights. But 1983, this is the start of the Thatcher Revolution. You know, the thumping of Michael Foot, followed by the sort of champagne years in the city that led up until that big crash. We are really seeing these characters written who I'm used to seeing a bit more from later 80s sort of drama and depictions. But when Tim Curry and Jonathan Pryce are sat drinking the most disgusting looking cocktails, which cost £11 for two drinks, which in that much, what's the equivalent of that? I mean, that is extraordinary for 1983, isn't it?
It's a lot now.
No, yeah, very expensive. Yes. Yeah, I wouldn't pay that.
Sorry,
much.
I drink in central London. But between that and the moment that I think we're going to listen to now, which is in the squash courts, they just are so obviously depicting a quite early depiction of that creature that we came to know as yuppies. So should we listen to the clip?
What have you been up to? Well, everyone's desperate for a new Falklands angle. Purdy's come up with a real dog. Workers' rights in Argentina. I've been running around trying to get people to do things, but no one's very keen. Workers' rights. Since when did anyone on that paper give a damn about workers' rights? I said to Purdy, look, tits, bingo, jingo, horoscopes, sport, celebs, gossip, the occasional firm stand on
the torture of small children.
On the torture of very small children. But I start telling them about their rights.
Yeah, Herman's rights. Herman's rights.
You know, we're even freighting in a couple of exiled RG trade unionists from Paris for a TV tie-in. One of them had his balls danced on by the secret police. The other had to be hosed off the wall of his cell after the police had introduced them.
Come on.
Yes, my good man. I'm sorry, this is a private conversation. You'll have to wait. Outside.
You can't smoke in here. This is a squash court.
But we booked it for a smoke, didn't we, James?
I'm afraid we haven't quite finished. Come on out.
Look, the court is ours for another half an hour. Run along.
I said out. On the other hand, a quiet drink in the bar might be slightly more comfortable. Hey, I've got some news on Suez.
Sarah, what did you make of that?
Well, I think it's very interesting that we're looking at a tabloid journalist possibly working on The Sun, which is owned then by Rupert Murdoch. And I think it's part of this film's interest for me is its commentary on newspaper hegemony and ownership. And I think the very crucial point that needs to be looked at is that this film was filmed and probably written as or shortly after Rupert Murdoch bought The Times and The Sunday Times, a kind of jewel in the newspaper crown of our country. And therefore that I think from that moment, a lot of particularly kind of intellectuals like Ian McEwan feared that all journalism was on a sort of downward trajectory into the mire. And I think it's a very telling point that that the Jeremy character is struggling to find news that his very commercial sort of proprietor and news editor, commercially minded news editors, would want to publish in a world where journalism is now just a commodity. It's like selling tins. It's like selling bags of flour. I think we 1981 was the moment where, you know, any last vestiges of kind of public interest journalism, you know, was thought by writers to have sort of vanished. And I think what's interesting to me is that they're not really interested at all in, as we mentioned before, about the causes of the war, of colonialism, of ideas, about anything. It's just keeping their jobs, getting their stories, getting up the greasy ladder. And they make light of this war that hundreds and hundreds of men died in.
I just think it goes even broader than that, because it starts off, doesn't it, right at the very start of the film. There's we're hearing a bit of Radio 4 just going into the news, and it's a trail for Woman's Hour.
They're all
and
men.
First of all, the interesting thing was all the guests on Woman Hour are all men, right? Okay, yes. But one of the men is some Eastern European, some professor of Eastern European history, who's going to tell us all, because this very posh woman who's introducing it, going to tell us all about how sort of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe manipulate the recent past to make it, you know, conform with the present. And the film kind of almost ends, it nearly ends, with Thatcher's speech, which she really did give in 1982. And the very, very end of her speech is, and I wrote it down because this is remarkable. They obviously just probably wet themselves when she did that. So we're having this in. And she says, "We'll tell the people the truth and the people will be our judge." And the whole point is there's no truth. If the truth is being manipulated, the truth of the present is being manipulated, the truth of the recent past is being manipulated, there is no truth. And kind of Plowman's Lunch is about the characters who are culpable in the making of this untruth. So that, as well, we live in, like the radical historian says, there's the danger is that we all now live in a permanent present. We don't know about our history, what really, really happened. And so it's about the present and journalism and who owns it, but it's also about publishing. It's also, you know, and who publishes what kinds of books and for whom, and who goes along with it. And the reason why I guess James is this kind of empty amoral shell is that he's just going with the flow. He's just trying to make it in this world.
Yes, and I suppose, you know, we're invited to ask how the Falklands will be viewed by historians. I think also an interesting thing Ian McEwan saying is that history is not safe in the hands of upstart journalists. You know, you should have proper historians looking at history. And yes, it's we're in the world of fake news, aren't we? We're in the world of, and even the title of the film, The Ploughman's Lunch, is about a fabricated thing to help pubs increase their lunchtime trade. So yes, absolutely. And there are layers and layers and layers of lies and fabrication, which I think, which is why this is such a great film and should, needs to be seen about four or five times before you actually get all the different layers, because it's very sophisticatedly put together.
It is. Yeah. It's like a novel. You actually, the words that are used, you have to actually think about them. They're actually there for a reason, more than most films, I think.
It's an interesting film because not an awful lot happens, in terms of the central storyline. There's a series of vignettes that don't necessarily build on each other. And yet by the end of it, your character has gone through two relationships with women, a mother and a daughter. His mother has passed away. We see him at her graveside.
Checking his watch.
I know, looking at his watch. That's one of the worst / best ends to a film. It's just like, oh my God, is he really looking at his watch over his mother's grave? He is.
What I thought, I felt it was a little heavy-handed at times, but what was quite clear was that in his mind, at least, his parents had to die for him to move on and become the thing that he wants to be. And for him to do the upwardly mobile and truly leave the past behind, he has to leave the past behind. And that means, leaving his mum and dad, no matter how unwell and how much they clearly love him. I mean, the affection from them, despite it being very clear that he lets them down very frequently. And her face when she wakes up to see him at her bedside, it's just heartbreaking.
And they're the only people that show him affection.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're the only two, and he doesn't want it. The people that he wants affection from, he doesn't get anything from. He gets betrayal.
One of the other things I thought was quite funny, was the contrast of two different types of left-wing politics. So you had the left-wing academic who was very bohemian and had sort of lots of partners with lots of different children from lots of different places, and she saw everything through that prism. There's a point where she says about somebody, oh, he has no politics, and she doesn't mean that somebody had no politics, she means he doesn't have her politics. And she is quite a monster. And then the only people I think that you are supposed to admire at all in this drama are the lovely ladies from the peace camp, who do have genuine politics and are out there actually doing something ultimately sadly futile. But, they are. And I have to admit that there's a very big soft spot in my heart for them, not least because one of the things I did do in the early 1980s was go to Greenham Common with my mum. To the peace camp there. So, this is something that is literally my own history. But they are so earnest and make some decent arguments and are just, as you said earlier, Steve, instantly dismissed as nutters.
But the kind in the film itself, though, because the film is totally bleak because there is no sense of how is this going to change. Yeah. It's more like this is it, because there are three like groups of nicest people, but in terms of the politics, yes, the peace camp campaigners are the most significant, and that they are lovely people. They're very helpful to him. They give him all this information. They just basically pleading with him to try and get them some national publicity, but they have no agency. He also sees them, doesn't he, when he's at the Conservative Party conference, where he kind of looks at them and blanks them. Yeah, and they're powerless. They're outside protesting, and they're not inside. How is that going to change? There is actually no hope. So that's part of the bleakness of it, isn't there?
Yes, I completely agree. At that time, the sort of the absolute control over news was in the hands of mainstream newspapers, television, and radio. But sort of, if you think about what would be happening today, I think this is where one gets hope in that one of them would be having a blog, they'd be having they'd have an Instagram account, they'd probably have a huge Twitter following, and people would be so much more aware of what they were doing. But back then, absolutely, the sort of the control of the, there were a few sort of underground magazines, but very, very small reach. That they were absolutely reliant on newspapers to give them some kind of a voice. As I mentioned before, it's one of the things that one expects good journalists to do, as well as hold power to account, is to give a voice to the voiceless, to those who can't speak for themselves. And they failed. He failed on both counts there.
And also Susan, because right at the start, when she's kind of explaining who she is, and she's a TV researcher, isn't she? And that you said, I think, Sarah, at the start, she's outlining a dispute between the feminists in the office and the men, who basically seem to run everything. And the feminists are saying the problem with this, the history that we're talking about, is it's all men's history, and there should so critiquing the very basis of what they were doing. And she literally says, well, I saw how, I couldn't understand what they were saying as a woman, but as a human being, I just didn't know what the point was. And she basically says, I had to make a decision, did I choose power or did I choose not power? And not power meant being all sisterly and nice and probably, green and common type peace activists. And she literally says, I chose power. And they're all looking, they're all sucking up to, accommodating themselves to, echoing what the powerful want, or what they think the powerful want.
Yes, she's perfectly aware of what she's doing. I think she says at that party, current affairs is all about what men do. So she's absolutely, consciously betraying the sisters. I'm quite surprised, pleasantly surprised by Ian McEwan, because he hasn't got a great record on the women's movement and women's issues. But I think, as we mentioned before about the news reader, so they've had the news, which is the men's world, and then he's announcing, the news reader's announcing Women's Hour as if it is a separate sphere. It's not the public sphere of news and politics. It's this separate sphere, the domestic sphere. I think we're to see there are a lot of quite interesting women's voices in this film, but they're all sort of muted by the sort of the male power structures, and of course by Susie, who's chosen to betray her sisters, as it were, in order to be part of this power structure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about looking at this film from this distance is that the Thatcher consensus feels so hegemonic in it. And of course we know that that was broken, at least to an extent. So I think that that's probably, an interesting critique of power that you wouldn't have if you watched the film at the time, if you see what I mean. At the time, it must have just felt like this is it, and this is, as I think you said earlier, Sarah, that's how the film ends. It just ends with them all being in this place and continuing to seek the power that they seek the way they're seeking it. No one learns any lessons in this film. But actually looking at it all these years onwards, there are definitely lessons to be learned from that kind of we are the gods, we are the masters of the universe, nothing can take us down approach. And lessons that people who are currently behaving in that way might want to have a think about.
Yes. And what I think is interesting, so many films about journalists have none of these characters. They have the kind of crusading kind of guy who wields his pen like a sword. I'm thinking of Russell Crowe in State of Play. I'm thinking of Gabriel Byrne in Defence of the Realm, which actually was produced the very next year after Plowman's Lunch, where you've got this heroic, almost kind of half detective, half sort of crusader who is after the truth, who is after holding power to account. That is the kind of classic newspaper hero. No, it's Woodward and Bernstein in fiction. And you have, I mean, deliberately, I think Ian McEwan's avoided showing anyone like that in this film, to really be almost unnecessarily bleak about the sort of how we see life, both the past and the present and the future, through the prism of mainstream journalism. And I think it's very interesting he didn't go down that route of having, at least, you know, like we have the press at the moment, the new TV series, you know, there is one sleazy tabloid hack and there is one kind of principled Guardian journalist. You don't have that principled journalist in the film at all, which I think adds to the kind of this idea that we've talked about of there really being no hope as you're watching it in 1983.
Absolutely. Well, that's a bleak feeling to end the podcast on.
On that bombshell.
No, I was going to say, you know, but I would like to reiterate that, you know, now it's not so bad because you do have a multiplicity of voices. They're still, you know, trying to work out ways of paying their journalists and all that kind of thing. We've got a long way to go, but at least there are alternative sources of news that a lot of people can get hold of these days.
Although sadly, some of those alternative sources of news reproduce all the terrible characteristics of the news that they're trying to counter. They're like a mirror image, aren't they?
You have to be careful.
The antidote to the sun is not the canary. Right, well, on that note, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Steve, thank you as always. And I'd just like to say thank you to Lord Stuart Wood of Anfield for our theme tune. And this has been A Political Human Podcast.